Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Thursday, April 18th. We are going to take the items in an order different than what's printed on the agenda. We are beginning with a public hearing on House Bill 2587. After that, we will proceed to an informational meeting on tobacco taxes. That will be followed by work sessions on a couple of bills that this committee, I believe, is ready to work on. And then the final item on our agenda will be the senior deferral program. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2587A.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. This bill would, deals with the senior deferral program in which the Department of Revenue pays property taxes to the counties and local governments on behalf of individuals that are either senior or disabled and qualify for the program. This would allow participants into the program that have a reverse mortgage enacted between 2011 and 2017, but mandates that they must have 40% equity in their home. And Representative Meek is here.
Thank you, Representative Meek.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Finley, Vice Chair Marsh, members of the committee. Thank you very much. My name is Mark Meek, and I'm the representative from House District 40, Oregon City, Gladstone, Jennings Lodge, and Johnson City. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2587A. Since 1963, the Oregon Property Tax Deferral Program for disabled and senior citizens has helped thousands of Oregonians stay in their home by allowing them to defer their property taxes. Currently, some of the individuals who need this program the most in order to stay housed are being left out. This was brought to my attention by one of my constituents in the Oakfield neighborhood of unincorporated Clackamas County. And after working his whole life and saving responsibly for retirement, my constituent should be able to qualify for this very important program. But his reverse mortgage means that he cannot. In 2011, after the aftermath of the Great Recession, lawmakers adopted some changes to the deferral program that with House Bill 2543 to keep it solvent during that very turbulent period. And one of those changes was to disallow seniors and disabled Oregonians with a reverse mortgage the ability to enroll in the tax deferral program. This was necessary to the financial to financially sustain the overall deferral program, but was a very tough decision. After all, many of those who had been had taken out a reverse mortgage had done so to stay in their home. So these are exactly the kind of struggling Oregonians that with who the deferral program was meant to assist in the first place, and they are now being left out. Eliminating reverse mortgage holders impacted a lot of program participants. In a study conducted by the Oregon State University for the Department of Revenue found that in 2012, shortly after these changes were made, almost one-fifth of the participants in the program had a reverse mortgage. So House Bill 257A restores the ability for many of these Oregonians with the reverse mortgage to qualify for the deferral program. It specifically allows for those with reverse mortgages executed between July 1st, 2011 and January 1st, 2017 to come back to the program. This bill is targeted in such a way for a couple of reasons. One, we don't want to open this program back up to every single reverse mortgage holder in the state because that could negatively impact the program's account in the long run. The legislature recognizes the impacts of eliminating reverse mortgage holders from the program past House Bill 4039 in 2012 to let them back into the program for 2 years. But many people, such as my constituent, executed their reverse mortgage soon after this 2-year window, unaware that this important deferral program would be phased out for people like him. So these folks were caught in the middle due to no fault of their own, and they should have the opportunity to gain access to this program again. Looking ahead, federal changes have helped to minimize the program, this program in the future. Since 2014, a guidance from HUD, and now in 2017, by rule, When writing a reverse mortgage, there must be a determination of the individual's ability or willingness to make real estate tax payments during the reverse mortgage. So if not, then a LISA, a life expectancy set aside account is required. So the LISA is supposed to cover the property tax payments for the rest of the person's life expectancy. This helps address the problem in a slightly different way for more recent reverse mortgages taking place after January 1st, 2017. So furthermore, when this bill came up in the House and Human Services housing last month, there was some discussion about including sideboards to ensure that the Department of Revenue would not be exposed to all the additional risks of adding these reverse mortgage holders. Therefore, the committee felt it would be prudent to require the reverse mortgage holder to have at least 40% home equity in order to qualify for the deferral program. Now that the account for the deferral program is healthy, I believe that we should continue the conversation about how to revive eliminated elements of the program that have historically been effective in keeping vulnerable populations housed. Allowing some of these seniors and disabled Oregonians with reverse mortgages to once again defer their property taxes and pay them back upon the sale of the property would be a positive step in this direction. I ask for your support of House Bill 2587A, and I'm happy to answer your questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions for Representative Meek? Yes, Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for this. I know the property tax deferral program is to help those who are in cash flow problems towards in retirement years, and so is the reverse mortgage. So I'm just wondering if we're compounding one program on top of another, even though the state doesn't bear the burden of the reverse mortgage. I think they're both going after the same thing, and I'm just kind of thinking that through a little bit.
If I understand your concern, that they're going to be basically working on and surviving on the equity of their home,
right,
in two capacities, one with the reverse mortgage and one with deferring the property taxes. And the new HUD requirements, like I was mentioning, starting in 2017, require that they, as part of their approval of this reverse mortgage, which those folks that are doing this now are eligible to receive that under those certain circumstances. So we're trying to take into account that they have the equity and the capacity to both survive off the equity of their home and get through the cash flow crunch of retirement, but while also maintaining responsibility to repay off all the remaining debts. So this bill would not actually affect the new folks participating in the program or any new reverse mortgages being applied for. This would only pertain to those folks between 2011 and 2017. And there were folks that actually participated during those 2 years with House Bill 4039, I think it was. Was here, 4039 that was passed in 2012 opened up a 2-year window that allowed some folks to participate. This would allow and gain access to some of the folks that have a current reverse mortgage and would qualify with the 40% equity and then be able to participate in this program to help defer some of their other expenses at this time.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. This is a great program, and I appreciate your work on it. I do have a question concerning the 40% equity. If I don't know whether you look at actuary tables or what, but today it's 40% equity, but the reverse mortgage continues to reduce that number of equity if it's paying out more than the appreciation. Is that as a snapshot of today only, or is it a snapshot over a 3 to 5 or 5 period?
Well, that's actually an excellent question. And those actuarials, those projections are considered when a mortgage company will take on that risk of the reverse mortgage. And I'm not a underwriter, and I'm not a mortgage lender, so I disclaim that right there. But part of their process and approval process is to make sure that with, you know, the average of appreciation of homes in the market, not speculated appreciation, but just average, and then their actual the expense or the income that they're taking out, depending on what type of program that they take out, because they can just get an equity line system, or they can have a takeout and then just amortize, let those payments kind of work, whittle away at the equity, or they can have payments made to them. So just depending, I'm sure a lender is going to be very, very risk averse, and they will be approving those loans subject to their qualifications.
Yes.
And is the mortgage, the reverse mortgage company in first, and the Department of Revenue in second, or are we sharing first position?
Do you recall that answer?
The Department of Revenue.
Yeah, Department of well, actually, yeah. The reverse mortgage is in first position, and then the Department of Revenue is in second, and that was what got us into that situation in 2011, and we worked on some of this. We tried to address some of those questions, and I don't think any mortgage broker or lender of sound mind would ever be willing to take a second position on it. So, but we're not asking for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll allow one more very brief question and answer, because I think Mr. Mullen needs to get to another.
I can defer.
Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen on behalf of AARP. I've been in the building for about a month, back in the building. And as you all know, AARP's mission is to enhance the quality of all of us as we age. This session, AARP has been involved in a number of different housing issues, and we've testified on them. And while we have no specific position on this bill, I would just say that AARP also endorses the values of independence, dignity, and choice. And this is a choice that is appropriate for many seniors and people with disabilities to take a look at this opportunity for the Senior and Disabled Property Tax Program. So I want to thank Representative Meek for coming forward with this concept. I want to offer a couple of brief personal perspectives to give a little background on the program. As I was the director of Clackamas County Social Services for many years, and we helped to work on this program in the community, getting information out, working with our assessor's office when people were in crisis. So it's important to think about this program from the perspective of the individuals that are in these circumstances. And we saw many, many issues that had multiple layers of problems, but getting people into this program was really very helpful for their independence. I worked with a disability advocate and Senator Vern Duncan, for those of you who remember Senator Duncan, to add people with disabilities to the program. That was back in 2005, I believe. Also worked with then co-chair Senator Schrader, co-chair of Ways and Means, when he had the idea of sweeping money for this program to support Oregon Project Independence. A lot of this you will find, by the way, in Basic Facts. There's a really good history here. I would point out there is an error in the Basic Facts. It says that Oregon Project Independence was established in 2005. It actually was established in 1975. The sweep happened in 2005. So there might be a need to go back and change that. The sweeps and the change in the housing market created the problem where legislators really had to dig in and say, we need to save this program, and made the changes that Representative Meek talked about under crisis. I had the good fortune of being able to work with people, including then Representative Jessica Vega Peterson, who took this on as an issue. We worked together on adding people back into the program, and we did this selectively and purposely and over time, over a number of sessions. And Madam Chair, I also worked with you when you were in your co-chair role in Ways and Means and the sub. To pay back property taxes for people who are in and out of the program. That was a one-time expenditure. The reason I bring all of this up is that there is an issue of fairness that's involved in this discussion from the time the program was cut to adding people back. And what Representative Meek's bill does, in my mind, is it creates a bit of a fairness about an era for people who would otherwise have been involved in the program or didn't realize that the program had changed. And so this is a time limited, and it seems to be a practical and modest kind of change to the program. I understand the corpus is pretty significant at this point in time, in excess of $40 million. So I don't think this in any way would jeopardize the corpus, which I know is important to all of you. We don't want to get upside down in the program once again. I think that in the couple of comments I'll make in conclusion is that it would be good in the future if the legislature never considered doing a sweep of this program again, in my estimation, and also that the idea about looking at future opportunities to change the program or modify the program or enhance the program is really important. Representative Meek talks about a continuing conversation about this off into the future. And as we think about housing collectively across many different sectors, different ideas, I hope that the issue about people being able to stay independent, living in their own homes with programs like this will be part of the consideration. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Questions? Representative Marsh, you had a question.
Just a quick question, thank you. Representative Meek, I just wondered where the 40% came from, the sideboard around 40% of equity retained. Is that just seem like a good number, or?
It was determined, but I worked with folks from the Department of Revenue to mm-hmm. determine a good calculus of what a good number would be for when you're looking at the time length and frame that it would take to mm-hmm. expand the full 40%
right.
with that type of program. And they felt that 40% was a good number to, I mean, statistically, in fact, I'm not sure what their number was, but they were very satisfied that we put that number in to make sure that the biggest important thing, there was no sideboards before that to qualify, and this will eliminate and give better direction of who can qualify and why they should be able to qualify.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Any other questions? Thank you both.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate your committee. Thank
testimony.
You very much.
There's no one else signed up to testify on this bill in the public hearing. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2587A. We are now moving to an informational meeting on tobacco taxes. First, I would like to hear from Legislative Revenue Office, please. This committee did have some questions, and could you please provide us any additional information or insights into either our questions or the testimony that we've heard so far?
Members of the committee, for the record, Dave Beck, Legislative Revenue Office. So on all of us, I have a couple of documents. One, approach to cigarette tax change analysis. So what I'm going to do is that basically I'm going to state what we do in our office to do the analysis. I'm forever scarred by my years at OEA, but I'm doing this. the commonly accepted price elasticity of cigarette consumption is negative 0.4. This is rather outdated. And a lot of analysis just take this number and run with. We don't do that for many reasons. We're talking about stamped cigarette price elasticity. That's higher than just, you know, typical cigarette consumption. Recent literature survey reveals much more elastic response. Typical numbers that are cited these days is negative 0.7. And I've seen even higher numbers. That means 10% increase in per pack cost reduces 7% decline in consumption. Smoking minors add to elasticity. And this is a point of contention, probably the price difference between Washington and Oregon. And commuting workers provide an incentive for Washington residents to buy cigarettes here in Oregon. We call them casual smuggling. Washington State loses a ton of sales, they claim, and partly because of casual smuggling, but that's part of the story. They have reservations sales, they have military sales, they have commercial smuggling operations too. All documented, but we're focusing on this casual smuggling for Washington residents to come across the border and buy our cigarettes, our Oregon-stamped cigarettes. Lower rate in Idaho is attractive to Oregon residents, so we lose sales. Not a ton, but still. Recent articles focus on directly estimating lost revenue and sales, partly because the elasticity assumption is subject to question. And depending on price point, elasticity changes. It's been documented. I'm going to touch on that. The availability, availability of other tobacco products and alternative products to high elasticity of cigarette consumption. Substitutability is there, then there'll be switch and different types, among different types. Price elasticity, this is something that's been revealed in most recent articles. Price elasticity tends to be higher when prices go up. And I've seen numbers reaching over one. That means 10% increase in price leads to 10% decline in consumption at higher prices. Finally, we only believe data. And Orzechowski and Walker is providing a ton of data, historical data, panel data. So in our office, we've done a simple but quite revealing panel that's cross-section across states. 50 states plus DC, and over a long period of time, 1970 through 2017, we've done analysis. We've seen many different kinds of elasticities. The examples are there. For those who want to replicate the studies, it's an open source. You can get the data. You can run panel regression. You will find the elasticity at different price points, different period, everything. So we've done our work to check the robustness of our analysis method. Some of the interesting references that I provided, the bottom. Congressional Budget Office in 2012 I found that lower-income people are more responsive to price increases. And that's been confirmed by other studies. All the studies are a little outdated, so just interpret the results with a grain of salt. I happen to follow some of my favorite economists, Gruber being one. I provided data. So comparing traditional economic analysis and a different method investigating human behavior. So what happens is people look for instant gratification, so they tend to overconsume cigarettes despite price increase. So to the extent we discourage that overconsumption behavior, the general public will be well solved. The next one is the most recent one by NBR for economists found a very interesting result. And I would not go back to use the data from 1991, but this is the study. What it says is this research is the first econometric study to examine the price elasticity of cigarette demand at different price points. So the conclusion there is the absolute value of the price elasticity of demand monotonically increases with price. So these authors find that at different price points, from $2 to $4 to $6 to $8 to then $10, at different price points, price elasticity increases monotonically. Overall, they found negative 0.7 in using different models, but at higher price level, they find more than one-for-one relation, meaning 10% increase in price reduces consumption by even more than 10%. What we can agree to is the increase in price discourages consumption and consumption declines for many reasons. If given opportunity, consumers respond rationally over time, so elasticity would increase over time. You can't change behavior right away, but you believe in rational behavior, people respond more with more elasticity. So now, in terms of cross-border, you have
the elasticity very significantly
with the distance individuals leave to a lower price border, and up to so what this is very much cited literature by Loveheim at Stanford. He found that up to 25% of population will travel to border states to purchase lower price cigarettes, up to 25%. Lower bound is 13%, upper bound is 25%. Now, that is built into our model. 25%. We're giving the maximum, actually. And the document that I will present next will show, using average behavior, how much we gain from Washington residents and how many cigarettes So there are two different numbers, actually. I'll get to them. But
before you go further, Representative Smith has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I didn't mean to interrupt, but we're talking about elasticity, and elasticity depends upon, in economics, rational behavior in order to measure the movement. Because we're dealing with a product that has high addiction level, can we still say that rational behavior would play out in elasticity?
That's a good point, Chair Representative Smith. So in the short run, like you mentioned, it's addiction, and you can't quit smoking. What we found in the literature is that over time, behavior changes, not instantly. So elasticity increases gradually over time. That's built in our model. Overnight, you can't change. That's why we start with a certain assumption, 0.7.
So really
you start with that, but then over time, you give a little bit of increase in elasticity.
And Madam Chair, just really quick, I think that what you just shared is exactly where I was trying to go for the committee. I think it's important for us to understand that behaviors are not going to change immediately. That, if I hear you correctly, sir, it's going to be over a more extended period of time. But over that extended period of time, behaviors would change. But it's going to take longer than perhaps the change of drinking milk or those type of activities. Thank you.
I want to do a time check. For anyone
who is here waiting to hear our discussion of the senior deferral program, we may not get to that because this is an important conversation we're having. And even though I had hoped that we would spend no more than 30 minutes on this informational meeting, it may in fact take a little bit longer. Go ahead.
So, this is a very important finding, actually. Often cited research, up to 25% of consumers purchase cigarettes across the border if the price incentive is there. The bottom line of this study is that the central implication of this study is cross-border smuggling confounds many of the potential health and revenue gains from cigarette taxation. But we have to produce numbers. We have to do our analysis. Despite this conclusion, we stick to certain principles, methods, and we generate numbers. Now, mentioned that recent literature focuses on sales elasticity. So there are two different implications. For one, for convenience stores, not just, you know, the cigarette purchase is done with some other purchases too. So for convenience stores, 10% increase in cigarette taxes, excuse me, not taxes, 10% increase in pack of cigarettes price lead to about 3 or 4% decline in sales of cigarettes. On the other hand, specialized tobacco stores, they'll see 1-for-1 decline. So two different kinds. That makes sense because convenience store purchases, you go there, you buy different things, and along with it, you buy also cigarettes. Or you go for a cigarette, you buy something else too. Tobacco stores are different.
We need to wrap up this portion so that we can move to the other right. Two people who we know will be speaking.
Right. Yes.
I do have two questions for you, but you probably had something you wanted to show us before you finish, is that right?
Yes. So, if you give me about a couple of minutes, I'll. So, this is the data provided by Dr. Fruits when he testified before. By the way, I'll be followed by Dr. Eric Fruits and yes. Dr. Daniel Morris. will present their cases. So this is directly taken from one of the testimonies, and this is industry level data that we are not typically privy to, the good source. So the yellow highlighted counties are border counties along the river. So what you have is in the second column, you have 2018 total packs in the counties sold. And you have all different statistics, but the second column is the actual distribution to these counties. And then apply Oregon average. And you calculate the county level, consumption level, applying Oregon typical average. And the difference, we will give 100% to Washington residents. So we're assuming that 100% is purchased by Washington residents. You total up, it's about 10 million packs a year. Now, within our model, using literatures, we had about 7.5 to 9 million packs sales to Washington residents in a typical year. So that's 10.5 million packs. That's the maximum we could give. But at the next page, we do the same calculation. We tallied the potential Washington residents purchase across the border based on Washington County distribution data. We had about 4.5 million packs purchased by Washington residents. So two different data points, two different numbers, but the maximum we could give is 10.5 million packs. The minimum we could give is 5 million packs purchased by Washington residents. I will provide the data. It's an open source by now. You can replicate the results easily. Now, within our model, I said adding 25% of Washington residents along the border come to Oregon side and purchase cigarettes. We had about 7.5 million packs to 9 million packs. That was the number we had before we get this data. This is the data, industry level data. It's credible. I have no doubt that this is a credible data. So we replicated results. Our internal model confirms the actual data. That's all I have.
Thank you. I hope we can limit our questions to just a couple of quick questions and very brief responses, because I would like to then ask for Eric Fruits to join us for 10 minutes and then Daniel Morris to join us for 10 minutes. So I think Hernandez was first and then Smith second.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be quick. It's based on what you were just talking about. Hypothetically, if we were to have a similar tax to Washington, what would that do to the casual, I think you mentioned the
smuggling.
Casual smuggling,
yes, sir.
Illicit market for Washington.
We looked at Washington state data over 10 years, 7-8 years. Smuggling has been there. They have large operations. I don't know why Washington's unstamped cigarette consumption is over 40%, whereas Oregon is less than 10%. I cannot explain that. Now, if we increase cigarette tax by $2 per pack, that becomes very close to Washington state price. Now, if we assume that we just wipe out entire sales by Washington residents from Oregon border, the 10 million packs a year, that's what we can give. There are a lot of numbers floating around, including 40 million packs, but based on data, we cannot confirm that, actually.
Okay. Representative Smith?
Yeah, two things very quickly. One, you can see the accuracy in your comments when you look at Sherman County per capita having the greatest number of sales. There's a convergence of Highway 97 that goes from Cape Fall Bend to Biggs Junction, crossing over the river into Washington. And so you can see exactly what you're talking about there. So I have a quick question, but it's I don't think we need to answer it today, but I'm hoping somebody can. When you look at the typical tobacco user, they tend to be, and I'm stereotyping here, but they tend to be below the per capita income. Their household income is below the Oregon average. And many of the folks below the Oregon average also tend to be on the Oregon Health Plan or eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. It would be very interesting for me to know what is the economic impact of smoking and its health effects on the Oregon Health Plan and what cost drivers tobacco has on the Oregon Health Plan. And to know that, is there a correlation or is it causation? I don't know the answer on that, but it'd be interesting to know that question. That when I talk to my constituents, that's the number one issue I hear is the folks who are providing economic stress on the Oregon Health Plan ought to help assist in its payment. Meaning if you're gonna smoke, you ought to help pay for the impact that'll come later in life. So I'm just curious.
We can look into that, working with
OHA. And that's a big question. I get that, and I'm not looking for an answer today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that at different price points, the elasticity changes. I'm wondering if we could get a graph at different price points and seeing where that how that curve looks at different price points of increasing packs from $1 to $2 to $3. And my second point, so that's just a request. The second one is I have data from the Washington Department of Revenue saying they're losing 88 million packs in evasion, not necessarily all to Oregon, but overall. And so those numbers concern me. If you're saying it's 10 million, and I'm hearing 40 million and 80 million, we need to really understand that number before we set a policy.
Just briefly, this is the data that was presented here. This is from industry level data, and I have no reason to doubt this is the accurate data.
Thank you, Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Just very quickly, I guess elasticity means one thing if our goal is to reduce smoking. It means a different thing if our goal is to raise money. So that's sort of the crossroads where we are right now. So there are multiple factors that have been mentioned as maybe influencing our ability to project cigarette revenues with an addition, including the decline in Washington sales, the decline in cigarette smoking projected by Oregon residents, and the potential for Oregon residents to go get their cigarettes someplace else. So with those factors, can you reasonably project what our revenues might be over the next couple of years with the projected cigarette tax?
That's what we are still working on. I can tell you this. We're starting with elasticity of 0.7. Mm-hmm. That's the number. That's the most recent comprehensive literature survey reveals to us. So we're starting with that. We are using add factors to account for just total elimination of Washington residents' purchase of Oregon-stamped cigarettes. And that's one factor. And the second, over time, we'll have to give a little more elasticity so that the over time, if not instantaneously, over time, the consumption behavior changes. So for 1921, we are starting with negative 0.7, but we're, this forecasting is precarious, really. This is not just, okay, take the number, take the elasticity and just run the number kind. You can't do that at this point. Because from $1.33 to $3.33, that's a substantial increase in price, state tax, that is translated to about 30% increase in pack of cigarettes. That 30%, it's not 5, 10%. We're talking about 30%, over 30% increase in pack price. So that's another factor we have to take into consideration. Just incremental change, we can talk about the elasticity. A big, substantial jolt should be treated with caution.
But safe to say, you are working on incorporating all of these factors into the financial modeling, and will come back to us with a conservative number? Okay.
We already have numbers.
Are those the numbers?
Appreciate the Legislative Revenue Office's numbers that we have gotten. But if you want to reiterate them, that's fine. Any other questions? Is it quick?
It is quick.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know the number for Washington in terms of packs for their casual smuggling data?
Entire Washington state?
You could calculate the impact.
Provided a glimpse of that analysis by Washington State Revenue Department. Their number, applying their census, let me put it this way. Dr. Fruit's presentation has a table.
Okay, I'll wait.
Yes.
Thank you. I would like to move now to asking Eric Fruits to join us. Committee, we will have time now only for 10 minutes of presentation and questions with Eric Fruits, and then we will have time for 10 minutes with Daniel Morris. And I'm going to give some thought to whether we're going to carry over our work session or try to extend for a couple of minutes today.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Marsh and Finley. I haven't really prepared anything for today. I was expecting questions, so what I'll start with
that's
is
fine.
I'll try to address some of the questions that have already been asked, if that's okay with you.
Thank you.
Beginning with Representative Hernandez, you asked about the casual smoking, cross-border sales in Washington. Oregon's Washington Department of Revenue estimates that about 88 million packs are consumed that are untaxed in the state of Washington. Some people call it smuggling. I think it's not all, I don't call it smuggling, it's non-taxed sales. They estimate that that's a little bit more than a third. There's been some research by the Mackinac Center, and they estimate that about half of that is attributable to casual cross-border sales. Again, I think everything we're doing here is more or less is an estimate. There's a lot of moving parts, but that's probably the closest we could get on that.
Representative Marsh, I think you did a really nice job of trying to balance out, I think, the objectives of this bill. You know, there's two things. One, you want to reduce smoking and the consumption of cigarettes, but you also obviously want to raise revenue. And this elasticity number we talked about, the 0.4, that is a consumption elasticity rather than a sales elasticity, which are two different things. Mm-hmm. If you apply the tax rate, that will amount to roughly a 33% increase in the price of a pack of cigarettes, and we'll talk about that in a second. If you apply that to the 0.4 elasticity, the estimate would be, if you accept that 0.4, would be about a 12% decline in the consumption of cigarettes in Oregon. And there's some other research. There's a lot of halves, it turns out. The rule of thumb is about half of that would come from people who quit smoking, and the other half would come from people who continue to smoke but reduce their consumption. Representative Smith asked about the Medicaid population, and I'm going off of memory here. Approximately 26, we'll round up, say about a quarter of Medicaid patients in Oregon are smokers, which is above the state average. The other thing to keep in mind, and also OHA estimates that about 375, I think it's a little bit more than that, about $375 million in expenditures by OHA they attribute to smoking-related issues. There was some testimony last week, I believe it was from OHA, I can't recall. It was a woman who gave the testimony, and she itemized the five-year savings that they could attribute to out of that 375. And when I tallied it up, if you put it on an annual basis, it represents about 2% of the total cost that the OHA spends that they attribute to smoking. So it's not going to make a very big dent even in the smoking-related cost of the Oregon Health Plan. It's important to remember that diseases related to smoking are build up over time. You all could go home and smoke a pack of cigarettes tonight and you would never notice it other than feeling terrible in the morning. But what happens is the way they measure is what's known as pack years. How many pack years have you consumed over your life? And that's how it builds up. So even if everyone who currently smokes quit smoking today, OHA would still face a big cost dealing with smoking-related illnesses because those will still pursue over time. For example, I think you heard testimony last week from a guy who quit smoking to take up e-cigarettes and has discovered that he now has emphysema because of his lifetime of smoking.
Can I interrupt you for a minute?
Please.
We do have some questions this morning. Can we go ahead and get one to you? Yes, Representative Fenley.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. You stated last time when you provided testimony that you felt that the numbers used as revenue generators coming out of these reports were vastly overstated. That may not be exact term. But
I wouldn't say vastly. I try to avoid adjectives or adverbs.
But you stated you felt they were overstated.
I thought they were overstated. I think that they underestimated the amount of cross-border sales that we would lose. And also that we'd lose to, say, Washington and to a smaller extent California, but also the extent to which we will see increased cigarettes coming in from out of state, potentially through Idaho in a casual sense, and then also from elsewhere in a commercial sense.
And that's where I wanted to get to, is why were they overstated? And that's probably the difference between the 88 million packs versus 10 million packs of Washington sales.
Yes, there's, I was actually able to duplicate the numbers that were presented by OHA and the governor's office, and it seemed to be very quick and dirty back-of-the-envelope calculation, where they simply, I could get essentially the same answer by taking the 0.4 elasticity, applying it to the 33% change in price, and doubling that number. And I'm like, wow, I got exactly what they got almost, within a small margin of error. Like, so I became more and more convinced, although I don't know how they did it, but that's how I got to that answer. And I don't know if that's how they got to it. I think there's a few things that we need to recognize is that Oregon has a slightly higher number of smokers, percentage of our smoking population smokes. It is higher, not a whole lot higher. But in Washington, although they have a fewer, smaller share of smokers, the people who do smoke smoke more cigarettes. If you put those two together, roughly the cigarette consumption per capita is roughly the same between the two states, but the cigarette sales per capita is vastly different, and we know that both at the county level and at the state level. And it seemed that the OHA and the governor's budget didn't seem to adequately reflect that observation.
Representative Reschke, is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then we'll come back if we have time.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Finley, for that. Mr. Fruits, is it safe to characterize that smoking occurs in the lower income strata disproportionate to the rest of the population?
And, I think that'd be a fair assessment.
And if so, are we then taxing poor people to pay for health plan? I mean, we're increasing the tax on something that is disproportionately used by poor people. And I mean, is that a fair characterization, or am I missing something?
I think that'd be fair. And there's another thing I'd like to add to it. I provided you guys a little Venn diagram that showed pre and post cigarette tax sales versus consumption, because remember, those are two separate concepts. And what's happening is you are shrinking both the amount of cigarettes consumed, because people will stop smoking or smoke less, but you're also going to reduce the amount of tax sales that are sold. And it's because people buy fewer cigarettes, and then you have greater cross-border sales. And what that does is that makes those two circles overlap. So not only do you have poor people paying a disproportionate share because they smoke more, but you're shifting the burden, the tax burden, to Oregonians from out-of-staters. You know, in a perfect world, what you'd want to have is zero people smoking in Oregon, but Oregon sells a ton of cigarettes to bring in revenue. And so, right? I mean, let's all be honest, we're grown-ups here, right?
Tourism,
we want to export our sin taxes. That's push our pain on someone else and get all the gain ourselves. But the challenge with the tax is high, because it's such a high, and I think that's the other thing to keep in mind. This is really kind of an unprecedented increase in taxes. And when we talk about elasticities, we're talking about very small changes in price. We're talking about a huge change in price that will make our, you know, if you exclude sales tax, Oregon cigarette prices will be higher than Washington. Add in sales tax, they'll be about the same. And so really, there's no incentive for anyone from Washington to come to buy cigarettes in Oregon unless they're just, you know, on their way home and they decide to pick them up.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you.
This will be the last question.
Sorry. So two quick things. Number one, on that, no incentive to come, except for the whole no sales tax. I mean, as part of, there are a lot of people who come to this state and buy things, and the convenience factor alone. I, on a regular basis, when I'm not organized enough to go to the cheaper gas station, I will go to the more expensive one by my house. And so I know a lot of other, I mean, we get a lot of people to come in, border, cross traffic, and if the prices are the same, and you're coming here to go to Costco so you don't pay sales tax, then I think it's just as likely that you're gonna buy cigarettes. But that actually, sorry, you just said that at the end, but what I was really gonna ask was the price sensitivity question. Is one of the items in Day's presentation from LRO was that indeed lower income people are more price sensitive than higher income people. So I would put that out in contrast to, it's not just straight up, this is disproportionately gonna hit lower income people. I would argue, I mean, doesn't that say that a lower income person is gonna be more price sensitive to this significant price increase and hopefully drive more behavior that way?
I think you hit on a good point there. The main point there's a lot of moving parts. They may be more price sensitive. There's also been evidence that they substitute away from other things, for example, food purchases, to purchase cigarettes. And so I think that's an issue too. There's, like I said, there's a lot of moving parts on the elasticity part of it. And the other thing too that you got to remember is that a lot of these decisions occur over a longer period of time. You may not have someone quit smoking overnight, that it may be something that builds up over 5 years. They say, that's enough, I'm sick of having smoking cigarettes. The other thing too, I think, is where it really impacts, the biggest impact will probably be on the casual smoker. I think one reason why Washington smokers smoke more is because the tax is relatively high, that you have fewer casual smokers. And so, you may stop, may put a halt to casual smoking in Oregon, which I'm not saying is good or bad, but that's another thing to be aware of. The sales tax issue is interesting. For example, at the current price differential between Oregon and Washington, you're saving $17 off a carton of cigarettes, and so that could be enough to send someone over to the border, to purchase their cigarettes at the Oregon Costco as well as their other groceries. There's evidence it may go the other way, right? They come to buy their groceries and they also buy their cigarettes, and so there are a lot of complementary purchases. The work I originally done was for the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association. Cigarettes are actually a very low margin product for them, but the cigarettes and the gasoline are what they use to sell the other products inside the store.
Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
We're going to have to move on to the next person, Daniel Morris.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Daniel Morris. I'm a doctor of public health. I'm a volunteer of the on the Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon, Upstream Public Health, and the Multnomah County Public Health Advisory Board. I have done research on tobacco taxes and the tobacco industry for over 10 years now. I've published a number of studies in peer-reviewed journals. My tobacco research has been cited over 100 times, including by the U.S. Surgeon General and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. My work on roll-your-own tobacco tax evasion got an editorial in the New York Times and a congressional hearing. So I'm happy to be here today to talk about this issue of cross-border sales. I've provided some prepared remarks that I won't go through in the interest of time, so make sure you'll have time for questions, but I did want to hit on a few things. So first off, we know that the tobacco industry's business model is to recruit new, younger users to replace those who their products kill, and to keep adult smokers smoking until they die to make more money off them. And to that end, they have engaged in a decades-long pattern of fraud and deception to basically conceal the hazards of smoking and the benefits of tobacco control measures. And part of that, by the way, this is why they were convicted of racketeering under laws that were put in place to take down the mafia, right? So part of this strategy of fraud and deception has been to fund a bunch of junk science to really just muddy the waters and confuse people around these issues. And one of the kind of one of their front groups is actually the Mackinac Center, who's been Dr. Fruit cited and has mentioned. Big tobacco companies have been funding them since the 1990s to basically to put out a bunch of kind of chaff to confuse folks. The Institute of Medicine and the National Research Council has done actually quite a bit of study and review of various studies on illicit sales and so forth, and concluded, and I've put this quote in here, that these industry-sponsored estimates of the size of the illicit market tend to be inflated, and those studies tend to have methodological issues and lack transparency in the methods, which make it difficult to evaluate. And that's I think this new study that you've seen from the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association is part of that body of work. I think you've heard testimony that illicit sales are so common that changes in them would dramatically impact the amount of revenue raised. I don't think that's true. For the record, I don't actually believe LRO's analysis of the price elasticity they use. I think it's too high. But even if you believe it, they conclude that only that fewer than, 10 million packs a year would result from Washington smokers. So that's actually probably the amount of revenue raised from those packs is probably within the margin of error of the entire estimate from what the new tax would bring in. And I think I wanted to read this quote to you. I think the one thing that's really important to understand is that tobacco taxes are one of the most studied things out there in the kind of the economics literature. And there's been a tremendous amount of good work, hundreds of studies, and in science we don't just rely on one study, but it's important to once there is this body of work to actually do like systematic reviews and look at the entire body to reach conclusions. And I think one of the kind of the premier leading researchers on tobacco taxes is Dr. Frank Chalupka from the University of Illinois at Chicago, and he did a recent study looking at this issue of cross-border sales, and I think it's really worth just kind of reading this. And I want to just sort of make sure I get it right. So he looked at over a 10-year period, every major state tax increase of over 50 cents. And he said, first, states that have implemented a significant cigarette tax increase have seen a significant increase in cigarette tax revenues in the 12 months following the tax increase. Second, states that border the state that raises its tax and that do not raise their own tax experience minimal changes in their own cigarette tax revenues, with tax revenues falling in most of these states. Third, any increase in cigarette tax revenues in states that border a state that raises its tax are modest at best, implying that overall, any increases in sales in other states due to cross-border shopping by smokers in neighboring states or bootlegging of cigarettes from lower tax states to a state that raises its tax are relatively small and are far below the reductions in sales of in the state that raises tax. Cigarette taxes, we know, are one of the perhaps the best, most powerful intervention to reduce cigarette consumption and improve and death and disease caused by smoking. But they're certainly not the only factor behind these trends that we're talking about. First, the tobacco industry spends about $1 million an hour marketing their products. Oregon has, for many years, been a test market for cigarettes. We don't have information, state level information, about how much the tobacco industry is spending here in Oregon. But if they're spending more in various places and in Washington, that information would be really useful to know in order to understand the sales trends. On the other hand, state tobacco prevention programs, there's a large body of research showing that they are effective at reducing consumption as well. And Oregon's program has kind of the dubious distinction of being one that was that was actually defunded and shut down at one point. So in 2003, the program was essentially shut down, people were laid off, contracts were canceled. It was started up again with reduced funding for a few years. Finally, in 2007, it was restored to voter-approved funding. During that defunding period, Oregon's the decline in consumption in Oregon actually stalled out and started to increase again. And the decline started again after the program was funded again. So that's also, this is not included in this trend analysis. And you know, these are, again, important factors, not the only factor, but it's this important context that we should know to make sense of the trends and looking at the to try to understand what the effect of these different rates. I appreciate Representative Smith mentioning this issue around the per capita number in Sherman County. I think you're absolutely right that that a relatively few number of long haul truckers who stop at the Biggs at the truck stop in Biggs Junction could actually dramatically affect the per capita cigarette sales number. I think it is not appropriate to just attribute all that to people from Washington sneaking across the border to buy their cigarettes. There are other explanations for that. I don't doubt that there are tobacco retailers in Oregon who are sort of willingly abetting tax evasion by Washington smokers. In fact, I think this committee heard testimony to that effect, that there are retailers who consider that sort of abetting this tax evasion to be sort of a fundamental part of their business model. But, you know, to be clear, when Washington smokers buy cigarettes in Oregon and take them home, they still owe Washington taxes on those cigarettes. And so failing to pay those taxes is breaking the law. I know that the Washington Department of Revenue, they must have folks who are trying to tax folks who are bringing untaxed cigarettes into the state. They also happen to have compacts with many of the tribes in the state to make sure that the cigarettes sold on tribal lands are taxed, and the people who are buying those cigarettes who are not tribal members pay those taxes. And for what it's worth, so. I guess I just want to. I guess just the last thing I just want to say before. Well, so I appreciate Dr. Fruits acknowledging that with Washington's sales tax, Washington taxes would still be higher than Oregon's, even after a $2 per pack increase. You know, people in Washington were still going to travel here to work. They're still going to travel here to shop, and they are still going to buy cigarettes in Oregon. But also thousands of smokers will quit. Thousands of kids will not start smoking, and hundreds of millions of dollars will be raised for the health plan and tobacco prevention programs. If the committee is truly concerned that a $2 per pack cigarette tax increase will not raise adequate revenues, I would just encourage you to raise the rate to $2.50 or $3 a pack, and to raise taxes on other tobacco products as well. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any
being with us. That concludes our informational meeting on tobacco taxes. Should we try to do
a... I know who my chair is.
Try to do a work session? I would like to do a quick work session. I'm closing the informational meeting on tobacco taxes. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2127. To make it formal, just tell us in 30 seconds what we're... 10 seconds, what we're having a work session on.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2127, the committee heard this earlier. We do have a -2 amendment, and what the amendment is doing is it's changing House Bill 2127 with the -2 is it's eliminating the sunset of the exemption from personal corporate income taxes for out-of-state emergency service providers that following a disaster, an emergency, come into the state temporarily and help to rebuild some of that critical infrastructure that's identified in statutes. The -2 makes eliminates the sunset or any sunset on this tax expenditure.
Okay.
Chair Nathanson, I move the -2 amendment be adopted in House Bill 2127.
Thank you, Representative Finley. Moves the -2 amendment be adopted. Any discussion? Any objections? Motion passes.
You're just voting.
Sorry. You're going to do the... Let me choose to do the main motion.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 2127 as amended to the floor with the good pass recommendation.
Representative Marsh moves House Bill 2127 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Motion passes, and the carrier is... Did we...
Are we on to 2164 now?
We're on 2127. I'll name the carrier at the end of the meeting.
I'm happy to do it.
That closes the work session on House Bill 2127, opening a work session on House Bill 2664.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2664, we do have the -1 amendment. And again, there's two provisions in this bill with the -1 amendment, and it's extending 6-year sunsets on both of these. So the first one is extending the 6-year sunset. This is for the manufactured part closure income tax credit. So this is a $5,000 refundable credit following a part closure of manufactured structures. Again, this is one of the standard credits that is up for review for this session. So it would be extending the 6-year sunset that exists in current law. And the second change is related to manufactured structures as well, but this would be a manufactured park. The capital gains. So it's a capital gains subtraction for someone who sells a manufactured park if they sell it to either the residents of the park or a nonprofit community that's purchasing it. So again, these are both 6-year sunset extensions. The -1 amendment just brings in a technical change language related to eminent domain. So that's the change in the -1.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, I move the -1 amendment be adopted into House Bill 2664.
Thank you. Representative Finley moves the -1 amendment adopted into House Bill 2664. Any discussion? Any objections? Motion passes.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 2664 as amended to the floor and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures.
Vice Chair Marsh moves House Bill 2664 as amended to the floor and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. Any discussion? Any objection?
Yes, I have a question. So did we move 2127 to the Joint Committee as well?
Or was that its own bill?
It's
an exemption, not a tax credit.
Okay, thank you.
Any objections? Motion passes. The carrier, I believe, is Representative. Oh, right, because it's going there first. that concludes the work on this bill. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2664. The carrier for House Bill 2127 will be Representative Marsh. Anything else for today? Our business is concluded. We're adjourned.